with no money, no way to communicate with his family, not knowing whether they were safe and sound in Paris, or, like so many others, buried in a shellhole somewhere beside a road, and above all, if anyone had told him that after France had been defeated he would still be alive, and would sometimes even be happy, he wouldn't have believed it. Yet that was what had happened. The very magnitude of the disaster, the fact that they had passed the point of no return, in itself provided some consolation, just as certain deadly poisons provide their own antidote. All his suffering was irreversible. He couldn't change the fact that the Maginot Line had been circumvented, or broken through, no one knew for sure, that 2 million soldiers had been taken prisoner, that France had been defeated. He couldn't make the post, the telegraphs or the telephones work, couldn't get hold of any petrol, or a car to go to the railway station 21 kilometres away, and there weren't any trains anyway, as the tracks had been destroyed. He couldn't walk to Paris, for he had been seriously wounded, and was only now just starting to get out of bed. He couldn't pay his hosts, for he had no money and no way of getting any. It was too much for him. All he could do was calmly stay where he was and wait. This feeling of absolute dependence on other people brought about a kind of peace within him. He didn't even have his own clothes. His uniform had been torn and burned in places, so he wore a khaki shirt and spare pair of trousers belonging to one of the farmhands. Meanwhile, he had managed to get himself demobilized by secretly crossing the demarcation line and giving a false address, so he no longer ran the risk of being taken prisoner. He was still living on the farm, but since he had recovered, he had moved from the bed in the kitchen to a little room above the hayloft. Through its round window, he could see lovely, peaceful fields, fertile land and woods. At night, he could hear mice scurrying above his head and the cooing of doves in the dovecot. Living constantly in fear of death like this was only bearable if you took one day at a time, if you said to yourself each evening, "Another 24 hours when nothing really bad has happened, thank God. Let's see what tomorrow brings." Everyone around Jean-Marie felt this way, or at least acted as if they did. They tended the animals, the hay, made butter. No one ever mentioned tomorrow. They made provision for the years to come, planting trees that would bear fruit in 5 or 6 seasons, fattening up the pigs they could eat 2 years later, but they did nothing about the immediate future. If Jean-Marie asked if it would be fine the next day, the usual question a Parisian on holiday would ask, they would say, "Well, we don't know. How should we know?" If he asked, "Will there be any fruit?" they'd reply, "Maybe a little," looking sceptically at the small, hard green pears trained up the trellis. "We can't really tell. We don't know. We'll see when the time comes." An almost hereditary instinct about the tricks of fate, the April frosts, the hail that ravaged the fields just before harvest, the drought in July that shrivelled up the kitchen garden, inspired wisdom and caution within them, but at the same time gave them something to do every day. "They're not exactly likeable, but you have to admire them," thought Jean-Marie, who had barely had any contact with the countryside. For 5 generations the Michauds had lived in the city. The people of this hamlet were welcoming and amiable. The men were smooth talkers, the women coquettish. Once you got to know them, you discovered they were determined, tough, sometimes even surprisingly malicious, perhaps a result of some obscure atavistic memory of hate and fear that had been passed through the bloodline from one generation to the next. Yet at the same time they were generous. The farmer's wife who wouldn't have given an egg to a neighbour and held out for every penny she could get when selling her poultry listened in dismal silence together with the rest of her family when Jean-Marie told them that he wanted to leave the farm because he had no money, that he didn't want them to have to support him, and that he would try to make it to Paris on foot. "It isn't right to talk like that, monsieur," she declared with a strange kind of dignity. "You're upsetting us." "But what else can I do?" said Jean-Marie, sitting next to her with his head in his hands, still feeling very weak. "You can't do anything. You have to wait." "Yes, of course. The post will be working again soon," the young man murmured. "And if my parents are actually in Paris..." "We'll see when the time comes." said the farmer's wife. Nowhere else would it have been as easy to forget the outside world. Without letters and newspapers, the only link with the rest of the universe was the radio. But the farmers had heard the Germans were confiscating the sets, so they hid them in lofts and old wardrobes, or buried them in the fields, along with the hunting rifles they were supposed to have handed over. The village was in the occupied zone, very close to the demarcation line. But the German troops weren't stationed there. In fact, they had only passed through the village and never climbed the hill to the hamlet, which was 2 kilometres away, along rough, rocky paths. Food was beginning to run out in the cities and certain other areas. Here there was even more food than usual, for there was no way of transporting their produce away from the village. Never in his life had Jean-Marie eaten so much butter, chicken, cream, or so many peaches. He recovered quickly. He even started putting on weight, the farmer's wife said, and in her kindness toward Jean-Marie, there was a strange desire to make a deal with the good Lord, to save one life for him in exchange for the other life he held in his hands. Just as she offered grain to the chickens in exchange for their eggs, so she tried to offer Jean-Marie's survival in return for her own son's life. Jean-Marie understood this very well. But it didn't change in the slightest his gratitude towards this elderly woman who had nursed him. He did his best to help out, doing odd jobs around the farm, working in the garden. Though the women sometimes asked him questions about the war, this war, the men never did. They were all former soldiers. There weren't any young men. Their memories remained stuck in 14. They'd had time to filter the past, to decant it, to get rid of the dregs, the poison, to make it bearable for their souls. But recent events remained confusing and laced with venom. Besides, deep in their hearts, they blamed it all on the youngsters, who weren't as strong as them, weren't as patient, and who'd been spoiled at school. And since Jean-Marie was young, they tactfully avoided judging him and his contemporaries. This was how everything conspired to comfort and soothe the soldier, so he could rebuild his strength and courage. He was alone almost every day. It was the season when there was the most work to do in the fields. The men left home before dawn, the women looked after the animals and the washing. Jean-Marie had offered to help, but they'd sent him packing. So he would go outside, crossing the courtyard where the turkeys were squawking, and walk down to a little meadow surrounded by a fence, where 2 horses grazed. There was a golden brown mare and her 2 little coffee-coloured foals with their short, rough, dark manes. They would come and rub their muzzles against their mother's legs as she nibbled the grass and shook her tail impatiently to chase away the flies. Every now and again, one of the foals would turn towards the place near the fence where Jean-Marie was lying on the grass, look at him with his dark, moist eyes, and whinny happily. Jean-Marie never grew tired of watching them. He wanted to write a story about these charming little horses, a story that would evoke this day in July, this land, this farm, these people, the war, and himself. He wrote with a chewed-up pencil stub in a little notebook which he hid against his heart. He felt he had to hurry. Something inside him was making him anxious, was knocking on an invisible door. By writing, he opened that door, gave life to something that wished to be born. Then suddenly he would become discouraged, feel disheartened, weary. He was mad. What was he doing writing these stupid stories, letting himself be pampered by the farmer's wife while his friends were in prison, his despairing parents thought he was dead, when the future was so uncertain, the past so bleak? But while he was thinking these thoughts, he saw one of the foals run joyously towards him, then roll around in the grass, kicking its hooves in the air and looking at him with mischievous and tender eyes. He tried to work out how to describe that look, all the time feeling impatiently curious and oddly anxious. He couldn't find the words, but he knew what the little horse must feel, how good the crisp, cool grass must taste, how annoying the flies were, the sense of pride and freedom when he raised his muzzle and ran and kicked. He quickly wrote down a few awkward, unfinished lines. They were no good. He hadn't captured the essence, but it would come. He closed the notebook and finally sat still, hands open in his lap, eyes closed, tired and happy. When he got back at dinner time, he immediately saw that something important had happened while he was out. One of the farmhands had gone into the village to get some bread. Now there he was with 4 round golden loaves on the handlebars of his bicycle and a group of women crowding round him. One of the girls saw Jean-Marie and shouted, "Hey, Monsieur Michaud, this'll make you happy. There's post again." "Really?" said Jean-Marie to the old man. "Are you sure?"
"Positive. I saw the post office open and people reading letters."
"Then I'm going upstairs to write my family a letter and take it to the village. Will you lend me your bicycle?" In the village, he not only posted his letter, but bought the newspapers which had just arrived. How strange everything was. He was like a castaway who had made it back to his homeland, civilization, society. In the little village square, people were reading letters from the evening delivery. Some of the women were crying. Many prisoners had sent their news, but had also given the names of friends who'd been killed. At the farm, they'd asked him to find out if anyone knew where Benoit was.
"Oh, so you're the soldier living there, are you?" the women asked.
"Well, we have no idea, but now the letters are coming, we'll soon find out where our men are."
One of them, an older woman who'd put on a little pointed black hat with a rose at the front to come down to the village, was crying as she spoke.
"Some of us will find out too soon. I wish I'd never got this damn piece of paper. My boy was a sailor on the Bretagne, and they say he went missing when the English torpedoed the ship. It's just too much."
"Don't you give up hope. Missing doesn't mean dead. Maybe he's a prisoner in England."
But to all these attempts at consoling her, she just shook her head, and the artificial flower on its brass stem quivered as she trembled.
"No, no, it's all over. My poor boy. It's just too much."
Jean-Marie headed back to the hamlet. At the side of the road he found Cécile and Madeleine, who'd come to meet him. They both asked at the same time, "You hear anything about my brother? You hear anything about Benoit?"
"No. But that doesn't mean anything. Can you imagine how many letters must be backed up, waiting to be delivered?"
As for their mother, she said nothing. She just shielded her eyes with her yellowish, dry hand and looked at him. He shook his head. The soup was on the table, the men were coming home. They ate. After dinner, when the dishes were dried and the kitchen swept, Madeleine went into the garden to pick some peas. Jean-Marie followed her. He knew he would soon be leaving the farm, and everything seemed even more beautiful and peaceful to him. It had been stiflingly hot for several days. You could hardly breathe until the sun began to set. But this was the time when the garden was at its most beautiful. The heat had withered the daisies and the white carnations bordering the kitchen garden, but around the well the rose bushes were in full bloom. A scent of sugar, musk and honey wafted up from the clusters of small red roses next to the beehives. The full moon was the colour of amber, shining so brightly that the sky was bathed in a soft green light as far as the eye could see.
"What a beautiful summer we've had," said Madeleine.
She'd taken her basket and was walking towards the stakes of green peas. Only a week of bad weather at the beginning of the month. And since then, not a drop of rain, not even a cloud. Though if it carries on like this, we won't have any more vegetables. And it's hard to work in this heat. But I don't care. It's still nice. As if the heavens have taken pity on us poor people. You can help if you want to, but you don't have to, she added.
What's Cécile doing?
Cécile? She's sewing. She's making herself a pretty dress to wear to Mass on Sunday.
Her skillful, strong fingers reached between the cool green leaves of the peas, broke the stems in half, threw the peas into her basket. She looked down as she worked.
So, you're going to leave us then? I have to. I'll be glad to see my parents again, and I've got to find some work, but...
They both went quiet.
Of course, you couldn't stay here your whole life, she said, looking down even more. Everybody knows that's how it is. You meet people. You say goodbye.
You say goodbye, he repeated quietly.
Well, you're much better now. You've got a bit of colour.
thanks to how well you took care of me. Her hand stopped still under a leaf. Have you been happy with us? You know I have. Well then, you'd better make sure you keep in touch. You should write, she said, and he saw her eyes full of tears close to him. She quickly turned away. Of course I'll write to you, I promise, said Jean-Marie, and gently touched the young girl's hand. Everybody says that. After you've gone, we'll have time to think about you here. My God, now it's still the busy season. We're working all day long, but when autumn comes and winter, we'll have nothing to do but look after the animals. And the rest of the time, we'll just stay indoors and watch the rainfall. Then the snow. Sometimes I wonder if I shouldn't look for work in town. No, Madeleine, don't do that. Promise me. You'll be much happier here. You think so? She murmured, her voice low and strange. And suddenly, picking up the basket, she moved slightly away from him so he couldn't see her through the leaves. He picked some peas, lost in thought. Do you really think I could ever forget you? He said finally. Do you think I have so many happy memories that I could forget this? Just imagine. The war, the horror, the war. What about before that? You weren't in the war forever, were you? So, before, were there... What? She didn't reply. You mean, were there women? Girls? Of course, that's what I mean. Nothing very interesting, my dear Madeleine.
But you're going away,
she said. And finally, without the strength to hold back her tears, she let them fall down her full cheeks and said in a voice choking with emotion,
I can't stand the thought of you leaving. I can't. I know I shouldn't say it. You'll make fun of me and Cecile will even more, but I don't care. I can't bear it.
Madeleine. She stood up straight. Their eyes met. He walked towards her and, gently putting his arm round her waist, drew her close. When he started to kiss her, she sighed and pushed him away.
No, that's not what I want. That would be too easy.
What do you want then, Madeleine? He said. That I promise never to forget you. Whether you believe me or not, that's the truth. I will never forget you. And he took her hand and kissed it. She blushed with happiness. Madeleine, is it true you want to become a nun?
It's true. Well, I wanted to before, but now, it's not that I don't love our good Lord any more, I just think it's not for me.
Of course it's not. You're meant to love and be happy.
Happy? I don't know, but I think I meant to have a husband and children, and if Benoit hasn't been killed, then...
Benoit? I didn't know.
Yes, we talked about it. I didn't want to. I had this idea of becoming a nun. But if he comes back, he's a good man.
I didn't know, he said again. How secretive these country people were. Discreet, wary, everything securely locked up, like their big wardrobes. He'd lived with them for 2 months and he had never even suspected there was anything between Madeleine and the son of the house. And now that he thought about it, he realized they hardly ever talked about this Benoit. They never talked about anything. But that didn't mean they weren't thinking about it. The farmer's wife called Madeleine. They went back. Several days passed. There was no news of Benoit, but Jean-Marie soon got a letter and some money from his parents. He was never alone with Madeleine again. He realized they were being watched. He said goodbye to the whole family at the door. It was raining that morning, the first rain in many long weeks. A chilly wind blew in from the hills. When he was out of sight, the farmer's wife went back inside. The two young girls lingered at the door, listening to the sound of the cart on the road.
"Well, it's not such a bad thing," exclaimed Cecile, as if she'd made an effort not to say anything for a long time, and now let a rush of words tumble out. "Maybe we'll get a little work out of you now. You've had your head in the clouds recently. I've had to do everything." "You've got no right to criticise me," Madeleine replied angrily. All you did was sew and look at yourself in the mirror. I'm the one who got the cows in yesterday, and it wasn't even my turn.
Well, I don't know anything about that. It was Mother who told you to do it.
Even if Mother told me to do it, I know who gave her the idea.
Think what you like. Hypocrite, hussy, and you want to be a nun?
As if you didn't run around after him, but he couldn't have cared less.
So? And what about you? He's gone, and you'll never see him again.
Their eyes burning with rage, they looked at each other for a moment. Then suddenly, a surprised, soft expression came over Madeleine's face.
Oh, Cecile, we used to be like sisters. We never fought like this before. It isn't worth it. Come on.
We can't have him, either of us. She put her arm around Cecile, who started crying.
It'll pass. Come on, it'll pass.
Dry your eyes.
Mother will see you've been crying.
Oh, Mother, she knows everything but says nothing.
They let go of each other. One went over to the stables and the other went inside the house. It was Monday, washing day, and they hardly had the chance to say two words to each other, but from their expressions, their smiles, it was clear they had made up. The wind blew the smoke from the laundry boiler towards the barn. It was one of those dark, stormy days in the middle of August when you can smell the first breath of autumn in the air. Madeleine didn't have time to think as she washed, wrung out and rinsed the clothes, and so she managed to put aside her pain. When she looked up, she saw the grey sky, the trees battered by the storm. "You'd think summer was over," she said.
"Not before time, filthy summer," her mother replied resentfully.
Madeleine looked at her, surprised, then remembered the war, the mass exodus, Benoit gone, the universal misery, the war still going on far away, and so many people who had died. She went back to work in silence. That evening she'd just shut the chickens away and was hurrying across the yard in the rain, when she saw a man on the road, walking quickly towards her. Her heart began pounding. She thought Jean-Marie had come back. A kind of wild joy shot through her. She rushed towards him, then let out a cry.
"Benoit?"
"Yes, it's me all right," he said.
"But how? Oh, your mother will be so happy. Did you escape, Benoit? We were afraid you were taken prisoner."
He laughed to himself. He was a large young man with a broad brown face and daring eyes.
"I was, but not for long."
"You escaped?"
"Yes."
"But how?"
"Well, with my friends."
And suddenly she became a shy country girl once more, with that ability, lost with Jean-Marie, to love and suffer in silence. She didn't ask him anything. She just walked alongside him without saying a word.
"And how's everything here?" he asked.
"Fine."
"Nothing new?"
"No, nothing," she said.
And leaping up the first three of the steps into the kitchen, she went inside the house and called out,
"Mother, come quick! It's Benoit! Benoit's come home!"
Chapter 31. The preceding winter, the first of the war, had been long and hard, but what of the winter of 1940-41? The end of November saw the beginning of the cold and snow. It fell on the houses destroyed by the bombs, on the bridges they were trying to rebuild, on the Paris streets where there were no cars or buses, where women in fur coats and wool hoods hurried by, where other women shivered and huddled in doorways. It fell on the railway tracks and on the telegraph wires, which were sometimes dragged to the ground by the weight and snapped, on the green uniforms of the German soldiers standing at the entrance to their barracks, and on the red flags with their swastikas draped over the monuments. In freezing apartments it cast a mournful, deathly pallor that made everything feel even colder and more inhospitable. In the poorer families, the old people and children stayed in bed for weeks. It was the only place they could be warm. That winter, Gabriel Cot's terrace was covered in a thick layer of snow. He and Florence put the champagne out there to chill. Cot would write, sitting next to the fire, which still didn't quite manage to replace the lost heat of the radiators. His nose was blue. He could have cried from the cold. With one hand he held a piping hot water bottle against his chest. With the other he wrote. At Christmas the cold became even fiercer. Only in the metro could you warm up a little. And still the relentless snow fell, softly, cruelly, on the trees along the boulevard de l'Essert, where the Péricans had come back to live. For they belonged to the French upper middle class, who would prefer to see their children with no bread, no meat, no air, rather than no education. And under no circumstances would they interrupt Hubert's studies, already so damaged by the terrible events of the past summer, nor Bernard's, who was nearly nine, and had forgotten everything he'd learned before the exodus, and was forced by his mother to recite "The earth is a sphere which sits on absolutely nothing," as if he were seven instead of eight. What a disaster! Snowflakes gathered on Madame Péricon's black mourning veil as she marched proudly past the long queues of customers in front of the shop, stopping at the entrance to wave like a flag the priority ration card given to large families. In the snow, Jeanne and Maurice Michaud waited their turn, leaning against one another like weary horses during a short pause in their journey. The snow covered Charlie Langelais' grave at the Père Lachaise Cemetery, the piles of wrecked cars near the Jeanne Bridge, and all the shelled, burned-out, abandoned vehicles left along the roads in June, tilted over on one wheel or on their side or ripped open, or nothing more than a twisted mass of steel. The countryside was white, endless, silent. Only after several days did the snow melt. The country folk were delighted. "It's good to see the earth again," they said. But the next day it snowed again, and the crows screeched in the skies. "There's a lot of snow this year," the young people murmured, thinking of the battlefields, the towns that had been bombed. But the older people replied, "No more than usual." In the countryside, nothing changed. Everyone just waited. They waited for the war to end, for the blockade to be lifted, for the prisoners to come home, for the end of winter. "There won't be any spring this year," the women sighed as February passed. Then the beginning of March, and still it got no warmer. The snow had disappeared, but the earth was grey and as hard as iron. The potatoes froze. The animals had nothing to eat. They should have been put out to pasture by now, but there wasn't a single blade of grass in sight. In the Sabaris hamlet, the old people shut themselves away behind their great wooden doors, which they nailed shut at night. The family huddled round the stove, knitting for the prisoners, without saying a word. Madeleine and Cécile were making little nightshirts and nappies out of old sheets. Madeleine had married Benoît in September and was expecting a baby. When a harsh gust of wind shook the door, the old women would say, "Ah, dear God, it's just too much." At the neighbouring farm, a baby was crying. He'd been born just before Christmas, and his father was a prisoner of war. His mother already had three other children. She was a tall, thin countrywoman, modest, reserved, who never complained. When people asked her, "How are you going to manage, Louise, with no man at home, with all the work, no one to help you and four children?" Her eyes would be sad and cold, but she would smile faintly and reply, "I have no choice." In the evening, when the children were asleep, she would go round to the Sabaris and sit down with her knitting next to the door so that she could hear if her children called her through the silent darkness. When no one was looking, she would secretly watch Madeleine with her young husband, without envy, without malice, but in silent sorrow. Then she would quickly look back down at her work. After a quarter of an hour, she would get up, put on her shoes, and say quietly, "Well, I'd better get going. Good night, goodbye, everyone," and go home. It was a March evening. She couldn't sleep. It was the same almost every night when she tried to fall asleep in the cold, empty bed. She had thought about having her eldest child sleep with her, but a kind of superstitious fear prevented her. That place had to be saved for her absent husband. On this particular night, a violent wind was blowing as a storm from the Morvan Mountains swept over the village. "There'll be more snow tomorrow," everyone said. In her large, silent house that creaked like a ship adrift at sea, the woman couldn't bear it any more, and for the very first time burst into tears. She hadn't cried when her husband had left in 39, nor when he'd said goodbye after his few days home on leave, nor when she'd found out he'd been taken prisoner, nor when she'd given birth all alone. But she just couldn't bear it any more. So much work to do. The baby was so big and wore her out with his feeding and crying. The cow hardly gave any milk because it was so cold. The chickens had nothing to eat and weren't laying any eggs. In the wash house she had to break the ice. It was all too much. She just couldn't do it any more. It was making her ill. She'd lost the will to live. What was the point of living? She would never see her husband again. They missed each other so much. At that moment he was probably dying in Germany. It was so cold in that big bed. She reached for the warming stone, which a few hours ago had been burning hot but was now icy cold, took it out from under the sheets and set it gently down on the floor. As her hand touched the freezing tiles, she felt an even icier chill run straight through her heart. She was sobbing violently. What could anyone say to ease her pain? You're not the only one. She knew that only too well. But other people seemed to be lucky. Madeleine Savary, for example. She didn't wish her harm. It was just too much. Life was too painful. Her thin body was frozen. It did her no good to huddle down under the eiderdown. She felt the cold seeping right down to her bones. It will pass. He'll come home and the war will be over, people would say. No, she didn't believe it any more. No, it will go on and on and on. Even spring didn't seem to want to come. Had there ever been such terrible weather in March? March was nearly over and the ground was still frozen, frozen to the core like her. Such harsh winds, just listen to them. They would surely blow the tiles off the roof. She sat up in bed and listened for a moment. A look of mild surprise suddenly passed across her sad, tear-stained face. The wind had stopped. Just as it had come out of nowhere, so it had now disappeared without a trace. It had broken branches off the trees, whipped the rooftops in its blind rage, carried away the last of the snow on the hill, and now, out of the dark sky devastated by the storm, the first rain of spring began to fall. Still cold, but torrential and urgent, carving its way down to the smallest roots of the trees, down to the very heart of the deep black earth. Part 2. Dolce. Chapter 1. Occupation. In the Angelier household, they were locking away all the important papers along with the family silver and the books. The Germans were coming to Bussy. For the third time since the defeat of France, the village was to be occupied. It was Easter Sunday, High Mass. A cold rain was falling. At the entrance to the church, the branches of a small peach tree, pink with blossom, swayed mournfully. The Germans marched in rows of eight. They wore their field dress and metal helmets. Their faces maintained the impenetrable and impersonal expression of professional soldiers, but their eyes glanced furtively, inquisitively, at the grey facades of the town that was to be their home. There was no one at the windows. As they passed the church, they could hear the sound of the harmonium and the murmur of prayers, but a frightened member of the congregation shut the door. The stomping of German boots reigned supreme. The first detachment swung past and was followed by an officer on horseback. His beautiful, dappled mare seemed furious at being forced to go so slowly. As she placed each hoof on the ground with reluctant care, she trembled, neighed, and shook her proud head. Great grey armoured tanks pounded the cobblestone streets. Then came the cannons on their rolling platforms, a soldier positioned high above each one to keep watch. The column of soldiers was so long that throughout the priest's sermon a kind of constant thunder resounded through the church's vaults. The women sighed in the shadows. After the metallic rumbling subsided, the motorcycles arrived, flanking the commandant's car. Behind him, at a respectful distance, came trucks, packed to the brim with large round loaves of black bread. They made the church windows rattle. The regiment's mascot, a thin, silent Alsatian dog trained for combat, ran beside the cavalryman who brought up the rear. Perhaps because they were so far away from the commandant that he couldn't see them, or for some other reason incomprehensible to the locals, these soldiers were more informal, friendlier than the others. They talked and laughed among themselves. The lieutenant in charge smiled when he saw the lone pink peach tree lashed by the bitter wind. He snapped off a branch. Since he saw nothing but closed windows all around him, he assumed he was alone. Far from it. Behind each shutter was an old woman, eyes as piercing as a knife, watching the conquering soldiers' every move. Deep within hidden rooms, voices groaned. Could you ever have imagined such a thing? He's destroying our fruit trees, for heaven's sake.
Seems this lot's the worst,
a toothless mouth whispered.
I heard they did a lot of damage before coming here, just our luck.
I bet they'll take our sheets, said one housewife. Just imagine, sheets I got from my mother. Only the best for them.
The lieutenant shouted an order. The men seemed very young. They had rosy complexions and golden hair. They rode magnificent, well-fed horses with wide, shiny rumps, which they tied up in the square around the war memorial. The soldiers broke ranks and started to make themselves at home. The village was filled with the sound of boots, foreign voices, the rattling of spurs and weapons. In the better houses, they hid away the good linen. The Angelier women, the mother and wife of Gaston Angelier, prisoner of war in Germany, were finishing their packing. The elder Madame Angelier, a thin, pale person, frail and austere, quietly read out loud the title of each book in the library and religiously stroked its cover before putting it away. "My son's books," she murmured. "To see them in the hands of a German. I'd rather burn them."
"But what if they ask for the key to the library?" groaned the fat cook.
"They'll have to ask me for it," said Madame Angelier. And standing very tall, she lightly tapped the pocket sewn inside her black wool dress. A bunch of keys she always kept with her jingled. "They won't be asking twice," she concluded darkly. She instructed her daughter-in-law, Lucille Angelier, to remove the decorative ornaments from the mantelpiece. Lucille wanted to leave an ashtray out. At first, the elder Madame Angelier objected.
"But they'll drop ash all over the carpets," Lucille pointed out.
Pursing her lips, Madame Angelier gave in. This older woman had such a transparent, pale face that she seemed to have not a drop of blood beneath her skin. Her hair was pure white, her mouth like the blade of a knife, her lips almost purple. An old-fashioned high collar made of mauve cotton, held rigid by stays, covered but didn't hide her sharp, bony neck, which pulsated with emotion like a lizard. When she heard a German soldier's footsteps or voice near the window, she would tremble from the tips of her small, pointy little boots to the top of her impressively coiffed head.
Hurry up, they're coming," she'd say.
They left only the bare essentials in the room, not one flower, not one cushion, not one painting. In the large linen cupboard beneath a pile of sheets, they buried the family picture album to prevent the sacrilegious enemy from seeing Great Aunt Adelaide at her first communion and Uncle Jules, aged 6 months, naked on a cushion. They packed away everything, right down to the mantelpiece ornaments, two porcelain Louis-Philippe vases decorated with parrots holding a garland of roses in their beaks, a wedding gift from a relative who came to visit less and less frequently, but whom they didn't dare offend by getting rid of the present, and the two vases about which Gaston has said, "If the maid breaks them while sweeping, I'll give her a rise." Yes, even them. They had been given by French hands, looked at by French eyes, touched by the feather dusters of France. They would not be defiled by contact with Germans. And the crucifix. In the corner of the room, above the sofa, Madame Angelier took it down herself, slipped it beneath her lace shawl, and held it to her breast. "I think that's everything," she said at last. She took a mental inventory. The furniture from the main reception room had been removed, the curtains taken down, the provisions crammed into the shed where the gardener kept his tools. Oh, the large hams smoked in ash, the jars of clarified butter, the salted butter, the fine, pure pork fat, the thick, streaky sausages, all her possessions, all her treasures. The wine had been lying buried in the cellar since the day the English army had left Dunkirk. The piano was locked, Gaston's hunting rifle was in an impregnable hiding place, everything was in order. There was nothing to do but wait for the conquerors. Pale and silent, with a delicate, trembling hand, she half closed the shutters, as you would in a room where someone had died, and went out, followed by Lucille. Lucille was a young woman, beautiful, blonde, with dark eyes, but a quiet, modest demeanour and a faraway expression, for which Madame Angélier reproached her. She had been acceptable because of her family connections and dowry. She was the daughter of an important landowner in the area. However, Lucille's father had gone on to make some bad investments, lost his fortune, and mortgaged his land. The marriage was, therefore, not the most successful. She hadn't had any children, after all. The two women went into the dining room where the table was set. It was just after 12 o'clock, but only according to the clocks on the church and the municipal hall, which they were obliged to set to German time. Every French home set their clocks back by 60 minutes as a point of honour. Every Frenchwoman would scornfully say, "At our house we don't live by German time." This practice left great voids at various points of the day when there was nothing to do. Now, for example, a deadly gap loomed between the end of Mass and the beginning of Sunday lunch. They didn't read. If Madame Angélier saw Lucille with a book in her hand, she would look at her, surprised, and say reproachfully, "What's this? Are you reading?" She had a soft, refined voice, as faint as the echo of a harp. "Don't you have anything else to do?" No one was working. It was Easter Sunday. They didn't speak. Between these two women, every topic of conversation was a thorn bush. They only approached with caution. If they reached out a hand, they risked getting hurt. Every word Madame Angélier heard brought back the memory of some loss, some family story, some former pain Lucille knew nothing about. She would reply with reluctance, then stop to look at her daughter-in-law in sad surprise, as if she were thinking, "How strange that her husband is a German prisoner of war, and yet she can still breathe, move, speak, laugh." She could barely admit that the problem between them was Gaston. Lucille's tone was never what it should be. Sometimes she seemed too sad. Was she talking about someone who was dead? Surely her duty as a Frenchwoman, as a wife, was to bear separation courageously, as she, Madame Angélier, had done between 1914 and 1918, just after, or not so long after, her own marriage. But whenever Lucille murmured words of consolation, of hope, her thoughts were similarly bitter. "Ah, you can tell she never really loved him. I've always suspected it. Now I can tell, I'm sure of it. That tone is unmistakable. She's cold and indifferent. She wants for nothing, while my son, my poor child..." She imagined the prisoner of war camp, the barbed wire, the guards, the sentries. Tears would well up in her eyes, and she would say in a broken voice, "We mustn't speak of him." Then she would take a clean handkerchief from her bag, always there in case anyone made her think of Gaston or the misfortunes of France, and delicately dab at her eyes with the same gesture she would use to remove a drop of ink with some blotting paper. And so, silent and still, next to the cold fireplace, the two women stood and waited. Chapter 2. The Germans had moved into their lodgings and were getting to know the village. The officers walked about alone or in pairs, heads held high, boots striking the paving stones. The ordinary soldiers stayed in groups. They had nothing to do, so they paced up and down the only street, or gathered in the square near the old crucifix. When one of them stopped, all the others did too, forming a long line of green uniforms that made it impossible for the villagers to get by. Faced with this obstacle, they simply pulled their caps even further down over their eyes, turned away and used the small winding lanes to return to the fields. The local policeman, under the surveillance of two non-commissioned officers, was putting up posters on the walls and main buildings. These posters were of various types. Some depicted a smiling German soldier with fair hair and perfect teeth, giving out jam sandwiches to a group of French children gathered around him, under the caption, "Abandon citizens, trust in the soldiers of the Third Reich." Other posters used drawings or caricatures to illustrate world domination by the English and the detestable tyranny of the Jews. But most of them began with the word verboten, forbidden. It was forbidden to walk down the street between 9 o'clock in the evening and 5 o'clock in the morning, forbidden to keep any firearms, forbidden to aid, abet or shelter escaped prisoners, English soldiers or citizens of countries which were enemies of Germany, forbidden to listen to foreign radio stations, forbidden to refuse German currency. And beneath each poster was the same warning in black lettering underlined twice, "On pain of death." Meanwhile, Mass was over and the shops were opening for business. In the spring of 1941, there was still no shortage of goods in the provinces. People had secreted away such hoards of fabric, shoes and provisions that they were now rather inclined to sell them. The Germans were not difficult and were prepared to be palmed off with junk, women's corsets from the last war, ankle boots from 1900, linen decorated with little flags and embroidered Eiffel Towers, originally intended for the English, they'd buy anything. They inspired in the inhabitants of the occupied countries fear, respect, aversion, and the amusing desire to fleece them, to take advantage of them, to get hold of their money.
"It's our money anyway. They stole it from us," thought the grocer, as he gave a soldier from the invading army his most charming smile and a pound of wormy prunes at double the price they were worth. The soldier examined the goods, sceptically. It was obvious he suspected fraud. But intimidated by the grocer's impenetrable expression, he said nothing. The regiment had previously been stationed in a small town in the north that had been destroyed and pillaged. There'd been no supplies for a long time. But in this rich province of central France, the soldier once more found things to covet. His eyes lit up with desire in front of displays full of reminders of comfortable civilian life, pine furniture, ready-to-wear suits, children's toys, little pink dresses. Their expressions serious and dreamy, the troops marched from one shop to the other, jingling the money in their pockets. Behind the soldiers' backs, or above their heads, the French sent little signals to each other from their open windows. They raised their eyes to heaven, shook their heads, smiled, made faint grimaces of scorn or defiance, an entire language of gestures, to show that they needed God's help during such terrible times, but that even God, that they intended to remain free, free in spirit in any case, if not in actions, then at least in words, that these Germans weren't really very clever, since they believed favours were done for them willingly, whereas the French knew they were obliged to, because, after all, the Germans were the masters. "Our masters," said the women, who looked at the enemy with a mixture of desire and hatred. The enemy? Of course. But they were also men. And young. The French took special pleasure in cheating them. "They think we like them, but we know we just want to get passes, petrol, permits," thought those women who had already met the occupying forces in Paris or the larger provincial cities, while the naive country girls shyly lowered their eyes when the Germans looked at them. On entering the cafes, the soldiers took off their belts and threw them on the marble tables before sitting down. At the Hôtel des Voyageurs, the non-commissioned officers reserved the main room for their mess. It was the kind of long, dark room you find in country hotels. Above the mirror at the back, two red flags with swastikas were draped over the cupids and burning torches that adorned the old gilt frame. In spite of the season, the stove was still lit. Some of the men had dragged their chairs up to it and basked in its warmth, looking blissfully happy and drowsy.
The large purple and black stove sometimes belched out acrid smoke, but the Germans didn't care. They moved even closer. They dried their clothes and boots. They looked pensively around, a look that was simultaneously bored and vaguely anxious, and seemed to say, "We've seen so many things. Let's see what happens here." These were the older, wiser ones. The younger ones made eyes at the serving girl, who 10 times a minute lifted open the cellar door, descended into the underground darkness, and emerged back into daylight carrying 12 beers in one hand and a box full of sparkling wine in the other.
"Sekt!"
shouted the Germans.
"French champagne, please, mademoiselle. Sekt!"
The serving girl, plump, round and rosy-cheeked, moved quickly between the tables. The soldiers smiled at her. She felt torn between the desire to smile back at them because they were young and the fear of getting a bad reputation because they were the enemy, so she frowned and tightly pursed her lips, without, however, quite managing to erase the 2 dimples on her cheeks, which showed her secret pleasure. My God, there were so many men for her alone. In the other establishments, the serving girls were the owner's daughters, and their parents kept an eye on them, while she... Whenever they looked at her, they made kissing noises. Restrained by a residue of modesty, she pretended not to hear them calling.
All right, I'm coming. You're in a big hurry,"
she muttered to no one in particular. When they talked to her in their language, she retorted proudly,
"You think I understand your gobbledygook?"
But as an ever-increasing wave of green uniforms swept in through the open doors, she began to feel exhilarated, overwhelmed, unable to resist. Her defence against their passionate appeals grew weaker.
"Oh, do stop it now! You're like animals!"
Other soldiers played billiards. The banisters, window ledges, backs of chairs were hung with belts, pistols, helmets and rounds of ammunition. Outside, the church bells sounded vespers. Chapter 3. The Angelier ladies were leaving their house to go to vespers when the German officer who was to lodge with them arrived. They met at the door. He clicked his heels, saluted. The elder Madame Angelier grew even paler and with great effort managed a silent nod of the head. Lucille raised her eyes, and for a brief moment she and the officer looked at each other. In a split second, a flurry of thoughts flashed through Lucille's mind. "Maybe he's the one," she thought, "who took Gaston prisoner. My God, how many Frenchmen has he killed? How many tears have been shed because of him? It's true that if the war had ended the other way, Gaston might today be entering a German house. That's how war is. It isn't this boy's fault." He was young, slim, with beautiful hands and wide eyes. She noticed how beautiful his hands were because he was holding the door of the house open for her. He was wearing an engraved ring with a dark, opaque stone. A ray of sunshine appeared between 2 clouds, causing a purple flash of light to spring off the ring. It lit up his complexion, rosy from the fresh air and as downy as a lovely piece of fruit growing on a trellis. His cheekbones were high, strong but delicate, his mouth chiselled and proud. Lucille, in spite of herself, walked more slowly. She couldn't stop looking at his large, delicate hand, his long fingers. She imagined him holding a heavy black revolver, or a machine gun, or a grenade, any weapon that metes out death indifferently. She studied the green uniform. How many Frenchmen, on watch all night, hiding in the darkness of the undergrowth, had looked out for that same uniform? And his sparkling, clean boots. She remembered the defeated soldiers of the French army, who a year before had fled through the town, dirty, exhausted, dragging their combat boots in the dust. Oh, my God, so this is war. An enemy soldier never seemed to be alone, one human being like any other, but followed, crushed from all directions by innumerable ghosts, the missing and the dead. Speaking to him wasn't like speaking to a solitary man, but to an invisible multitude. Nothing that was said was either spoken or heard with simplicity. There was always that strange sensation of being no more than lips that spoke for so many others, others who had been silenced. And what about him? The young woman wondered. What must he be feeling, coming to a French home where the head of the house is gone, taken prisoner by him or his comrades? Does he feel sorry for us? Does he hate us? Or does he just consider our home a hotel, thinking only about the bed, wondering if it's comfortable, and the maid, if she's young? The door had closed on the officer a long time ago. Lucille had followed her mother-in-law, entered the church and knelt at her pew, but she couldn't stop thinking about the enemy. He was alone in the house now. He had taken over Gaston's office, which had its own entrance. He would have his meals out. She wouldn't see him, but she would hear his footsteps, his voice, his laughter. He was able to laugh. He had the right. She looked at her mother-in-law, who sat motionless, her face in her hands, and for the first time felt pity and a vague tenderness for this woman she disliked. Leaning towards her, she said softly, "Let's say our rosary for Gaston, mother." The old woman nodded in agreement. Lucille started to pray with sincere fervour, but soon her mind began to wander. She thought of the past that was both near and distant at the same time, undoubtedly because of the grim intrusion of the war. She pictured her husband, a heavy, bored man, interested only in money, land, and local politics. She'd never loved him. She'd married him because her father wished it. Born and brought up in the countryside, she had little experience of the outside world, with the exception of a few brief trips to Paris to visit an elderly relative. Life in the provinces of central France is affluent and primitive. Everyone keeps to himself, rules over his own domain, reaps his own wheat, and counts his own money. Leisure time is filled with great feasts and hunting parties. This village, where the forbidding houses were protected by large prison-like doors and had drawing rooms crammed full of furniture that were always shut up and freezing cold to save lighting the fire, had seemed the very picture of civilization to Lucille. When she left her father's house, deep in the woods, she'd felt joyous excitement at the idea of living in the village, having a car, sometimes going out to lunch in Vichy. Her upbringing had been strict and puritanical, but she had not been unhappy. The garden, the housework, a library, an enormous damp room where the books grew mouldy, and where she would secretly rummage around, were all enough to amuse her. She'd got married. She'd been a cold, docile wife. Gaston Angelier was only 25 when they married, but he had had that kind of precocious maturity brought about by a sedentary provincial lifestyle. Excellent rich food eaten in abundance, too much wine, and the complete absence of any strong emotions. Only a truly deceptive man can affect the habits and thoughts of an adult while the warm, rich blood of youth still runs in his veins. During one of his business trips to Dijon, where he'd been a student, Gaston Angelier ran into a former mistress, a hatmaker with whom he'd broken off. He fell in love with her again, and more passionately than before. She had his child. He rented a small house for her in the suburbs and arranged his life so he could spend half his time in Dijon. Lucille knew everything, but said nothing, out of shyness, scorn, or indifference. Then the war. And now, for a year already, Gaston had been a prisoner. Poor boy. He's suffering, Lucille thought, as the rosary beads slipped mechanically through her fingers. What was he missing most? His comfortable bed? His fine dinners? His mistress? She would like to give him back everything he'd lost, everything that had been taken from him. Yes, everything, even that woman. Realizing this, realizing the spontaneity and sincerity of this feeling, she also realized how very empty was her heart. It had always been empty. Empty of love? Empty of jealous hatred. Sometimes her husband treated her harshly. She forgave him his infidelities, but he had never forgotten his father-in-law's bad investments. She could hear the words ringing in her ears, which more than once had made her feel he'd slapped her face. "Imagine if I'd known there wasn't any money!" She lowered her head. But no. There was no resentment left in her. What her husband had undoubtedly been through since the defeat, the recent battles, flight, capture by the Germans, forced marches, cold, hunger, death all around him, and now, being thrown into a prisoner of war camp, all that wiped out everything else. Please just let him come home to everything he loved. His bedroom, his fur-lined slippers, strolling in the garden at dawn, fresh peaches picked from the trellis, his favourite dishes, great roaring fires, all his pleasures, even the ones I don't know about but can imagine. Please give them back to him. I don't ask anything for myself. I just want to see him happy. As for me... Lost in thought, she let the rosary slip from her fingers and fall to the ground. She realized everyone was standing up. Vespers was over. Outside, the Germans were standing around in the square, the sunlight glinting off the silver stripes on their uniforms. Their light-coloured eyes, their blonde hair and their metal belt buckles gave a feeling of cheerfulness, energy and new life to the dusty spot in front of the church, which was enclosed within high walls, the remains of ancient ramparts. The Germans were exercising their horses. They'd set up a dining area outside. Planks of wood, the local carpenter had meant to use to make coffins, formed a table and benches. The men ate and looked at the townspeople with amused curiosity. You could tell that 11 months of occupation hadn't yet made them blasé. They regarded the French with the same cheerful surprise as in the early days. They found them odd, strange. They couldn't get used to how fast they spoke. It tried to work out whether this defeated people hated them, tolerated them, or liked them. They smiled from afar at the young girls, and the young girls walked by, proud and scornful, just like on the first day. So the Germans looked down at the crowd of kids around their knees. All the village children were there, fascinated by the uniforms, the horses, the high boots. However loudly their mothers called them, they wouldn't listen. They furtively touched the heavy material of the soldiers' jackets with their dirty fingers. The Germans beckoned to them and filled their hands with sweets and coins. It felt like a normal, peaceful Sunday. The Germans added a strange note to the scene, but the essential remained unchanged, thought Lucille. There had been some upsetting moments. Some of the women, the mothers of prisoners, like Madame Angelier, or widows from the other war, had hurried home, closed their windows and drawn their curtains so they wouldn't have to see the Germans. In small, dark bedrooms they cried as they reread old letters. They kissed yellowing photographs draped with black crepe and decorated with red, white and blue ribbons. But just like every Sunday, the young women gathered in the village square to chat. They weren't going to miss out on an afternoon when they didn't have to work, a holiday, just because of the Germans. They had on their new hats. It was Easter Sunday. Furtively and with inscrutable faces, the men studied the Germans. It was impossible to tell what they were thinking. One German went up to a group of them and asked for a light. They gave him one. They responded to his salute warily. He went away. The men continued talking about the price of cattle. As on every Sunday, the notary went over to the Hôtel des Voyageurs to play cards. Some families were returning from their weekly visit to the cemetery, an almost pleasurable outing in a village where there was nothing much to do. They went in a group. They picked bunches of flowers between the graves. The teaching nuns brought the children out of the church. They made their way through the soldiers. They were impassive beneath their wimples. "Will they be here long?" murmured the tax inspector to the court clerk, pointing to the Germans. 3 months, I've heard," he whispered back. The tax inspector sighed. "That'll force prices up." And with a mechanical gesture, he rubbed the hand that had been lacerated by a shell explosion in 1915. Then they changed the subject. The bells that had been ringing since the end of Vespers grew fainter. The final low chimes faded in the evening air. To get home, the Angelier ladies took a winding lane. Lucille knew its every stone. They walked in silence, responding to greetings with a nod of the head. Madame Angelier was not liked by the villagers, but they felt sorry for Lucille because she was young, because her husband was a prisoner of war, and because she wasn't stuck up. They sometimes went to ask her opinion about educating their children, about a new blouse, or about how to send a package to Germany. They knew there was an enemy officer lodging at their home. They had the most beautiful house in the village. And they expressed sympathy that they too had to be subjected to the law, like everyone else. "Well, you've certainly got a good one," whispered the dressmaker as she passed them.
"Let's hope they'll be on their way soon," said the chemist.
And a little old lady who was trotting along behind a goat with a soft white coat stood on tiptoe to whisper to Lucille,
"I've heard they're all bad and evil, and that they're causing misery to all us poor people."
The goat gave a jump and butted a German officer's long grey cape. He stopped, laughed, and wanted to stroke it. But the goat ran off. The frightened little old lady disappeared, and the Angelier ladies closed the door of their house behind them. Chapter 4. The house was the most beautiful for miles. 100 years old, it was long, low, and made of porous yellow stone that in sunlight took on the colour of golden bread. The windows that gave onto the street, those of the most elegant rooms, were carefully sealed, their shutters closed and protected against burglars by iron bars. The small window of the pantry, where they hid prohibited food in an array of different jars, lay behind thick railings whose high spikes in the shape of a fleur-de-lis impaled any cat who wandered by. The front door, painted blue, had the kind of lock you find on prisons, and an enormous key that creaked dolefully in the silence. Downstairs, the rooms had a musty smell, that cold smell of an empty house, despite the constant presence of the owners. To prevent the draperies from fading and to protect the furniture, no air or light was allowed in. Through the panes of glass in the hall, the colour of broken bottles, the day seemed murky and overcast. The sideboard, the antlers on the walls, the small antique engravings discoloured by damp, were drowned in the gloom. In the dining room, the only place the stove was lit, and in Lucille's room, where she sometimes took the liberty of lighting a small fire in the evening, you could smell the smoky perfume of sweet wood, chestnut bark. The dining room doors opened out onto the garden. It looked its saddest at this time of the year. The pear trees stretched out their arms, crucified on wires. The apple trees had been cut back, and their branches were rough, twisted and bristling with spiky twigs. There was nothing left on the vine but some bare shoots. But with just a few more days of sunshine, the early little peach tree in front of the church would not be the only one covered with flowers. Every tree would blossom. While brushing her hair before going to bed, Lucille looked out of her window at the garden bathed in moonlight. On the low wall some cats were howling. Beyond was the countryside, secret fertile valleys thick with deep woods and pearl grey under the moonlight. Lucille always felt anxious at night in her enormous empty room. Before, Gaston would sleep there. Would get undressed, grunt, bump into the furniture. He was a companion, another human being. For nearly a year now, there had been no one. Not a single sound. Outside, everything was asleep. Without meaning to, she stopped and listened, trying to hear a sign of life in the room next door, where the German officer